Well, let's talk a little bit about short stories. One of the things that I want to ask you about is when you were young, and especially since you wrote Mercedes Cain when you were 19, where you started out as a child in terms of your writing and thinking about writing, and were there things that you worked on and abandoned? Was there a time that you thought you were going to be a poet or thought you were going to write movies or changed your mind?
I was brought up in a family where, very happily, it was never suggested to me that I would ever have to work for a living. Not that I would be taken care of, but just my parents are impractical people, so I never thought that I would have a job or that writing would be a job. But when I was a little kid, I wrote rhyming poetry. And then when I was in college, I took poetry and playwriting and fiction writing. And the poems I all wrote were monologues. And the plays I wrote were always really heavy on monologues. I was a terrible playwright because all my characters ever did was tell stories about their childhood that would go on for pages and would remind each other of stories that they wanted to tell. And I think I ended up being a fiction writer. I like to think because I was better at it than I was at poetry or playwriting, but largely because I was a fairly serious poet, not a playwright. I knew I was going to be a playwright because you have to spend a lot of time with actors, and they're very, very tiring people. I mean, nice, but they're always, like, if you have a meal with actors, they're always standing up on chairs and pretending to faint in places where it is embarrassing to be with someone who's pretending to faint. But I thought I might be a poet, and seriously, I applied to graduate school, and I got in fiction and not in poetry.
There, but for the grace of God goes.
Seriously,
you.
If I'd gotten, I think it's really, I'm a remarkably aimless person. And I think that if I had gotten in to the poetry program and not the fiction program, I might be a poet now. Maybe, I don't know. They sort of said, this is what you should write, and to some extent, that's what I did. For me, graduate school was sort of learning some work habits, because my work habits were appalling, and my other work habits, I have to say, were learned entirely from Ann Patchett. But it was also just spending a lot of time writing, and it's possible that if I spent a lot of time writing poetry, I would have realized what a bad poet I was, because I don't have a very elliptical mind, and I think good poetry is fairly elliptical.
Keeping on the whole short story novel thing, I believe there's practically no one who is equally good at the short story or the novel. I think Updike is, I think Marquez is. Just about everybody I can think of who write both, I could say, well, you know what, he really is a better X, she really is better at Y. And you are somebody who writes short stories and novels very well. And I would put you in that Updike category as somebody who goes back and forth very easily. And what I wonder is, I judged a first novel contest a couple of years ago. It was first novels and first books of short stories for Penn, and I had 275 books. And of those 275 first published books from major houses that had been chosen by the houses to put into this contest, maybe six of them were good. They were horrible. I'm judging Best American this year, and I'm reading now tons of short stories, and they are all fabulous. I don't know how in the world I'm going to choose. They are so incredibly good, which made me wonder what's going on. Why is it that there are so many better short stories than there are novels, in my humble opinion? Because I've always thought that actually it was harder to write a really great short story than it was a novel. So that's part of the question. I'm interested in knowing what you think about that. And also, if the roles of publishing were reversed and the publisher said, we'll give you a two-book contract, we'll accept that novel, but only if you swear you'll write a collection of short stories, because we just really want to publish collections of short stories. If the weight was on short stories, because every short story writer is pressed towards writing a novel, and if you write a great story or a great collection, the question is always, okay, we'll take this as a favor to you, but when are you going to pony up and do your real work, your grown-up work, your novel? So if that was reversed, do you think that you would just write short stories?
It's an interesting question, because I went for a long time, once I started writing novels, scarcely writing short stories and not really thinking about it. And I'm a garbage disposal writer, as you well know, which is that I will try to put anything that occurs to me into whatever book I'm working on at the moment. It's that I don't, it's very rare.
And then
rare
I
for
pull
me.
It out.
Yes, the man has to pull it out. You know, this is a novel that takes place on Cape Cod, and there's a sudden road trip to Arizona because you want to make a joke about Arizona. It's probably not a good idea. And I guess about a year and a half ago, an anthology asked if I would write a short story, and the shtick of the anthology was that you wrote them anonymously. It's a book that came out in June called The Secret Society of Demolition Writers. I think that's right. And they got a bunch of writers to the theory, you know, like the tagline of the book is, what would you write if nobody knew who you were? And I was so intrigued by that idea that I said, yes, I'll write a short story. And I'd written a couple of short stories in the meantime. I made a couple of attempts at it, but I had such a good time. I've since written another short story and have been thinking about a book of short stories for the first time in a really long time. So maybe the answer is yes. If people were saying, oh, why aren't you writing short stories? I would be writing short stories all the time. I do think it's harder to write a good short story than a good novel. Because I, too, have read first book contest, a published book, not a publication prize, and have been surprised by how many first novels were really short stories. Either they were clearly short stories that had been expanded into a novel, or they were novels written with short story techniques. And my theory is that it may be because so many writers go to MFA programs, and you really learn to write short stories, that people have more technical chops when it comes to short stories now. I taught at the University of Iowa for 3 years, the fall semester in a row, and the question was always, how do you teach people novel writing in a method that's really designed for short story writers? And in fact, I did teach a course, a novel workshop, in which everybody in the class was working on a novel. You put up 100 pages at a time. Everybody in the class made the commitment to read 100 pages. You had to have written at least 50 pages of the novel, because nobody should be showing the first 20 pages of a novel they've written to people. When I was teaching at Iowa a few years ago, I had a student who I just adored who put up the first 12 pages of a novel he'd written like the week before. I'm not a yeller in workshop, but I really said, Jack, this is the stupidest thing you've ever done. I don't want to discuss this piece. And he was really very, he was a lovely guy, and I said, I'm so sorry, I didn't know. Because in fact, the workshop process is, for novels, has to be different than it is for short stories. It just absolutely has to be. And so I wonder if that's one of the reasons why the fault with a lot of first novels that are published is they're written by good writers who have technical skills, but they're trying to apply all of the things they've learned about writing a really good short story mm-hmm. to a novel. And my friend Bruce always used to quote to me that piece of wisdom that the difference between writing a short story and a novel is that, you know, a short story is like a wild, passionate affair, and a novel is like a long marriage. And I would always say back to him that for me, a short story was a hard blow to the solar plexus, and a novel was a long, lingering illness you might never recover from. And then when I started writing a novel, and I don't know if you felt this when you went from short stories to novels, that I really had always thought, I wrote short stories with a lot of characters that took place over a lot of years, and I thought the transition would be easy. I would just do one of those and take my time. And I was astounded at how different the process was, how different the process of developing characters was, how different my relationship to characters inside of a novel was, how different everything was, in fact. And I do think now going back to short stories, I definitely write different sorts of short stories than I did before I wrote a novel. I hope they're better short stories. They're more short story-like. I'm equally aware of the difference going back.
I think my whole life that I was writing short stories when I was young, it was like I had my shoes on the wrong feet. And the minute that I started to write a novel, that was it. The first chapter, I never wrote a short story again. And, well, I wrote that one that was so horrible.
It wasn't that
horrible. No, I distinctly remember you saying to me, I'm so glad to see that you don't nail everything you try. It was so bad. But I just instantly thought, oh, I'm a novelist. oh, I didn't know. All these years I've been trying to write a short story, and it's been a real struggle for me, but it's because I'm a novelist. The way that short story writing and what I learned about short stories, though, really influenced my work has to do with chapter shape. I'm going to put that on hold for a second because I want to circle back and ask you something. Do you think that if a group of incredibly dedicated and smart teachers who maybe were editors and not necessarily writers themselves, or best yet, some combination, that there could be a novel writers program, that there could be a program where you had poetry, short fiction, and novel writing, and you let five people in?
I'm always uncomfortable talking about myself, which makes moments like this very difficult. I actually invented the class, and now some other teachers teach it, and I invented the class because I was teaching at the University of Oregon, and there was a young woman who was working on a novel. It was a very small program, extraordinarily nice people, smart, nice people in the program. They had all been together for 2 years, seven people in the class. They had read everything that she had done, and she was putting up the same novel, and she got terrible workshops under the absolute best circumstances. And actually, she's teaching in upstate New York, and I told her about this, and she said, seeing that made me think there should be a novel writing workshop. Mm-hmm. And she said that, yes, she thought it actually caused damage to her novel,
sure,
workshopping it, because even these people who had been reading all along would ask questions of 20 pages of a novel the 20 pages of a novel could not and should not answer, about plot questions. Again, perfectly smart people saying, you know, I want to know about her relationship with her father, and that comes later in the book. I do think the only way to really successfully workshop a novel is to have people read as much of it as they can at one time. And the major problem with the novel writing class that I taught, which would be part of the problem with doing a program, would be that people were so interested in the notion of taking it, they would lie to get in and say that they had 40 to 50 pages of novel. You had to have written 50 pages, but you didn't have to workshop all 50 of those pages.
Right.
You just had to have gotten past those first tender pages. And you had, meaning that you'd have some level of commitment to the book. And I have to say, and all the time that I taught that, there were novels that were clearly never going to be finished, and novels that were clearly going to be terrific. And I do think that the workshop was equally useful for both sorts of pieces. But, you know, I would have students say that they weren't ready to commit for a date for workshop because they had to admit they hadn't actually written any pages yet. And boy, did we see some really bad novel excerpts by somebody who wrote them, the 50 pages, literally in 2 weeks. I mean, I think it probably was useful in some way because it was useful for them to have to work that intensely for a little while. But it was clear that those books were never going to be novels, or at least they were not going to resemble their final self. Yeah, I think it actually would be interesting to sort of say in a graduate program, because there are some people who have never written a short story. I'm actually married to a novelist who has never written a short story. I think he's now written a short story after working on his third novel for a while.
The basis of the logic that I have a problem with is if you put a short story up in workshop and people give you comments, they're giving you comments for revision. If you put 50 pages of a novel up, they're giving you comments for direction. And I don't ever want comments for direction, unless they're from you. The only person who reads my work while I'm writing it is Elizabeth, which has always been true. I don't sell a book until I'm finished with it. I couldn't bear to hear from five different people, I think she should go this way. No, that doesn't make any sense. She should die. No, she shouldn't die. She should get married. I mean, that would ruin me. And I have a really strong compass. Because the problem where people fail in workshop is they don't have a strong compass. So they hear all of these different opinions and they just spin. But if you didn't actually have the work to go home and look at and say, all right, you know, these are the opinions and this is what I've got, as opposed to these are the opinions, now which way am I going to go? It's like having everybody put in their two cents about where you should go on vacation or college or something like that. I would find it really hard for me. But at the same time, I think that there is this inherent problem. There are more people who want to be novelists. They're training a short story writers in order to be novelists. And that's not necessarily a good training for novelists.
I mean, I have to say, in terms of the workshop, having gone through a million workshops, at this point in my life, I can't imagine going to a short story workshop. And I had a great experience in graduate school. I had friends who graduated from graduate school and immediately found a writer's group, and I thought, no, no, I'm done with that. Partly because, for me, one of the reasons to go to graduate school was to develop my compass, if that's
right.
It's probably an unfortunate mixing of metaphors, but to understand what I felt about my own work. And certainly when I teach a novel writing workshop, I try to steer discussion away from prescriptive advice. In a short story workshop, when I teach it, I don't say anything until the end. In a novel writing workshop, I actually do say, let's talk about blank. Let's talk about the entrance to the book. You know, are you clear? Do you have enough? Do you understand what the book's about? Let's talk about the shape of the book so far. And try not to say, this book is great, but I think they should all be Mormons and it should be set in Florida or that sort of thing.
Now, the question I started to ask you before was how short stories influenced your sense of chapter. What's the relationship between a chapter and a short story?
Gosh, you know, it's a good question, and I'm not sure I know the answer. Because, and I know this is true for you, my sense of what a chapter is changes from book to book. I think my first novel was, all the chapters were more short story-like and were 25 pages long. And my second book was a lot of little chapters, and some were longer than others. The first draft was 450 pages, and I think there may have been 317 chapters.
All with titles.
Which, frankly, was the reason there were so many chapters. I really like titles a lot. And the titles really cracked me up. The thing that made me really sad is that there was a short chapter that was entirely about the main character losing his hair. And the title of the chapter was Adieu, My Friends, We Must Part. And I just thought that was so funny. And sadly, both of them are gone now from the book. I certainly think learning to think about shaping something ahead of time affects the way I think about a short story. I mean, I know that in your first book was, every chapter was about 25 or 30 pages. Is that right, Patron Saint?
All of my books except Magician's Assistant, they're all 20 to 25 page chapters, which is very much on the short story model for me. I mean, it's definitely the part of the short story that I never got away from. I'm stuck. What about nonfiction? Are you interested in writing nonfiction?
Yes, you know, I am. I do write a little bit of nonfiction that I like. This is the fourth year that I've written something. The New York Times has what I always think of as the dead people issue at the end of the year, the lives they led. A little piece that you write about somebody who's died in the past year, and has done them too. And I really enjoy those because they're a mixture of book research, which, because I used to be a librarian, I adore. And because I've never done anybody famous, just a huge amount of leeway about imagining the lives of these people. The one I just wrote was about the guy who did the voice of Tony the Tiger, the most famous of the people who I've done. And I really love those. I like writing personal essays too, although I'm a morbidly private person, and so they have to be not like really personal essays. The sort of thing that would be nothing for other people to reveal in an essay, you know, just really makes me nervous. But I do love writing them, and I may someday write a nonfiction book. Again, because I love research, and for all of my fiction, I do a lot of book research and anything that means I can sit in a basement and read microfilm makes me happy. That a book that would require that kind, not reporting, I don't think I could ever write as something that really required reporting.
Again, I want to ask you 20 questions at once, and I'm going to ask you one more question and then let other people ask you questions. So let's talk about revision. Elizabeth has the most soul-crushing revision process of anyone in the world.
I believe you once said, if I wrote the way you did,
I would kill myself. Yeah, I would. And I don't mean that metaphorically. I really, really would. I will read draft after draft after draft after draft of Elizabeth's books, and the drafts bear no resemblance to one another. They don't contain the same characters. It's like, one book starts in the 1800s and the next book starts in the 1850s with the children of those characters, and then they go on and on. For every 100 pages she keeps, she probably throws 300 pages away. And that's just my idea of hell. It kills me to watch that process, because what you're throwing away is fantastic. It doesn't belong in that book that you're writing. But to get to that book, you have to write through the history of the world. Why?
Why? Because when I teach, I can frequently talk about Anne's process versus my process, because I often think I would never have written a novel except for the fact that Anne and I were in this fellowship program together called the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, and Anne was working on her first novel. I think you gave me the first 75 pages in a chunk. And then after that, I got a chapter as it was written. And the first 75 pages, I do remember, we very timidly gave each other work, because we really liked each other personally.
You know that awful moment where you like someone and you know that you have to read their work, and you know that if you don't like their work, you can't date them or be their friend in the same way.
And I remember taking the book home and I sort of said, yeah, you know, I'll get to this in the next few days. And I sat down on the bed and looked at the first page and turned over. The next thing I remember is turning over the last page in the same position as I was laying on the bed. And ever since, we've had what we call the Insti Edit service, which means if we send something to the other person, that person will read it that day, just about. It might take 2 days, and we do like clear it ahead of time. We wouldn't send it to the other person on their wedding day or something like that. But I sort of feel like I learned how to write a novel because I watched somebody do it in the next apartment. It was like watching a barn being raised. But one of the huge differences between the way we work is that Anne can do a great deal, and she wrote her first book in the first 6 months of our fellowship, revised it the last month of the fellowship, and sold it shortly thereafter. And this was a fellowship program I went back to 2 years later, and Anne was still something of a legend for having done this. And there was a writer there who said to his girlfriend, at the time you've been complaining about writing, Anne Patchett has written another chapter. And he also, the same person said, I said, well, you know, one of the things that she does is she thinks about the book for a long time without taking a book. And he said, it's an accounting trick.
That's right.
Separate ledgers. And this is the metaphor I always give to my students. Somebody once asked Michelangelo, how do you carve the David? And he said, helpfully, you take a block of marble and you cut away everything that's not David. And in Des Moines, Iowa, where my mother is from, although she would want me to make it clear she's from West Des Moines, Iowa, at the Iowa State Fair, there is another extremely talented sculptor. Besides Michelangelo, there is a woman who's called the Butter Cow Lady.
I was going to say, the Butter Cow Lady?
The Butter Cow Lady, exactly. The Butter Cow Lady makes a life-sized cow out of butter every year, and it is amazing. And it's got, you know, it's really realistic. It's got veins on the udders. It's got, you know, the little tassely tail. And she will do another sculpture as well. She did the Last Supper in butter at one point. And it's in a refrigerated case, in case you're wondering. And also I can report that you can recycle butter for 5 years before it goes rancid. So it doesn't waste quite as much butter as it might. And what I say to my students is that there's some people who can take a giant block of butter and cut away everything that's not a cow. And there's other of us who have to spend a lot of time churning the butter. And my process requires a hell of a lot of churning. I can't think about a novel. I mean, I can, but then when I begin to write it, everything changes. The only really useful way for me to think about fiction is through writing fiction. I'm an exceptionally literal person, and anything abstract just boondoggles me. So basically, what I need to do is get a lot of writing on the page and then find the cow inside of it. I don't know another way to do it, because I think that if I wrote a novel fairly quickly without doing that, because I can't think abstractly about it, it would be a not uncomplicated novel.
In a bad way.
See, I feel like your metaphor isn't quite right. I feel like you take that giant block of butter and you carve a cow, and then you look at the cow and you say, no, that cow needs to be the Last Supper. And you push the butter back on. It's the same butter, but you reshape it into the Last Supper, and then you reshape it into the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and then you shape it into three calves. And, you know, there's the thread is the butter. But you're making an entirely different sculpture.
I suppose it's true. And I guess part of it is that I really don't know what I'm interested in until I have the material on the page. I don't necessarily know what I will be compelled by until it's on the page. And believe me, I know it's painful to watch. Just imagine what it's like to live it every day.
Well, but I do imagine it, and that is what's so painful.
When you're a writer, there's some things that get easier, and there are some things that never get easier. I mean, I sort of think, for instance, when you're writing your first novel, no matter what, you spend a lot of time saying, is this a novel am I writing, or am I writing the equivalent of that book that Jack Nicholson writes in The Shining? The same reason why, when you're writing your first novel, and people say, what are you working on, you always say, a thing, a big thing.
A longer thing.
A longer thing. And that gets easier, I think. In your second novel, you actually are aware that you're writing a novel. You know that you can do it. The sort of the fear of exposure of the depths of your soul that I think is terrifying in your early work before you're ever published, that I think goes away. Or at least it did for me.
And the fear of the depths of exposing the depths of my soul is how boring the depths
yes,
of my
exactly.
soul really are. So that I always am writing this novel thinking, this is so excruciatingly dull. And I have a better idea for a novel, and I should abandon this incredibly dull thing that I'm working on and go for the more exciting thing that is now crossing my radar screen.
See, for me, that's one of the things that gets better, is that I don't necessarily...
Yeah, it does get better. It gets better just in that I understand it.
Right.
And so I still feel it in the same way, but I can say, okay, now I know that I have felt this X number of times, and that it always turns out okay. Right. And so I can have more... I can operate more on faith, blind faith.
I'm also a very kind of fairly manic writer in that... Not that you're more psychologically balanced than I am when you write, that I go between thinking that I am the greatest genius in the entire world to the next day believing I am the worst fraud who ever walked the earth. And I think that for me personally, I have to do that. I sometimes tell my students that every writer should have the same mantra, which is, I'm a genius with much to learn. That is what every writer needs to believe, that you need hubris and know that you don't have it right. But unfortunately, myself, I only can believe one of those two things at any given time. But I think it's the thing that sort of, that without the hubris that I sometimes feel, like thinking, my God, this is so great. This is going to be the best thing that I ever wrote, possibly the best thing anybody's ever written. And that allows me to get work done. And then I have horrible crashing doubts. And that helps me to go back, and it's sort of like two sides of ambition. The, you know, the delusions of grandeur, and then the need to make it better. The obsession with how have I failed and how can I get around it. But I think that has something to do with how my process works.
The crushing part for me is that plagiarism thing, the self-plagiarism, that I just write the same book over and over again. And I do believe that we all have a certain number of playing cards. You know, you might have 5, you might have 10, you might have 15, but you just play the same cards over and over and over again and try your best to hide the fact that you're just playing the same cards.
And it is embarrassing when you think you've written something that you've never written before.
Oh my God.
And then suddenly you realize how it is exactly the same.
Elizabeth just read the first 100 pages of the novel that I'm writing, and last night, it was a big deal. We talked about it for the first time. I've been writing this forever. And we hysterically parsed out every single aspect of it. You're just like, okay, that goes in Taft, and that goes in Bel Canto, and that comes from there, and that comes from there. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe nobody else will know.
I would like to say that I did not read the first 100 pages of her novel, which is astoundingly good.
This would be a patron saint moment if we moved this to the beginning of the book.
But I didn't suddenly say, hey, this is great, and Can I do the footnotes?
Well, one of my questions, which might be a sort of introduction to you two, since we didn't give you a formal one, we just sat down and all started talking. But there's a nice story about how you two became friends at Provincetown. Do you want to tell it?
We were both fellows at the Fine Arts Work Center in 1990-91. We'd both gone to Iowa. I'm a couple of years older than Elizabeth, so... What year did you start Iowa?
It was there 88 to 90.
Okay, and I was there 85 to 87.
And we'd had like a story published in the same magazine. All of a sudden, yeah. I'd heard your name several times in a row before we met.
We were supposed to get there on October 1st, and I got there on October 3rd, which is hysterical because we were talking this morning about how punctual we both were. But it had to do with a guy, and so I got there a couple of days late, and I missed all the getting to know you parties, and I didn't know anyone, and I was really miserable and lonely. And after I had been there for about 3 nights, I was talking to said guy on the phone, and it was 9 o'clock at night, which for me is very late. And he said, I want you to go out and knock on doors until you can find someone to go out with. And this is, you know, this is absolutely your assignment. I'm hanging up now. And I was so lonely that I went out and started, the fellowship has a bunch of apartments sort of around a parking lot. And I went and started knocking on doors. And after 3 or 4 completely random doors where no one answered, how lonely must I have been? Elizabeth answered the door.
Meaning it was not her first choice.
No. And I said, Do you want to be my friend? I was pathetic, but do you want to go have ice cream?
We drove to Ben and Jerry's and discussed our mutual hatred of Kevin Costner.
That's right. It was our first conversation.
And over the winter, Anne taught me how to drive, because I did not drive. Thought of myself as a non-driver. And and I watched her write a novel. On the last day of the fellowship, we printed out our books and stood on them to see how much taller they made us. It was something very pleasing. We put in Anne's little apartment, we put them on the floor and stepped up and stepped down.
It was amazing to have that much time. And I think that that's also what's so great about an MFA program. Mm-hmm. It's having that much time with people and finding people who can be your reader, which I didn't find when I was getting my MFA, but found afterwards with Elizabeth. And I think that's one of the great quests for writers, is to find someone who understands what you're doing and who you can really hear and knows what to say at the right time and that sort of thing.
Not that 15 years ago was that long ago, but back in those days we had the dot matrix printers with the long and sitting ripping pages apart to give them to Anne, you know, bending back and forth the tractor, whatever, the stuff that went through the tractor feed. And
I always say Patron Saint of Liars was the first book written entirely on Winstons and Good and Plenty's, which dates it more than anything. Other questions?
I'm curious about your relationship with silence in your work, whether during or before or after a large project you're working on. How did you kind of learn to manage that, or do you go through periods of long silence in between?
This is a question about silence in working and whether after a long project you experience a period of silence. And I have never been a write every day writer.
Me neither.
I do sometimes think that I will start a book fairly soon after I've finished a book. And part of it is that in my personal process, I work on a book until people say, you know, how do you know when a novel is done? And for me, it's when I despise it so thoroughly that I can't bear the idea of working on it anymore, which frequently means that I'm really champing at the bit to start working on the next project. However, generally speaking, whatever I work on in those months right afterwards never gets into the book, ever. A sort of allowed silence. It may be that that's the way my brain is recharging for the next thing. One of the other things Anne and I have in common is that we both had as a teacher Alan Gerganis, who was just the most extraordinary writing teacher.
Absolutely.
So generous and smart. But the only thing he ever said that I disagreed with was that real writers write every day. You should always write every day. And I don't believe this is true partially because I don't. And partially because I feel like there are enough reasons to get down on yourself when it comes to writing that to add
a sense that you have failed if you haven't written every day is a bad extra thing to put into your life. I know a lot of writers who do believe it, and if you need to believe that to work every day, then that's great. I mean, I basically think that it's like any rule of fiction writing, it actually is dependent on the writer.
I also have turned out a whole lot more work than every writer I know who writes every day.
Yeah. I think there are people who need to approach it as a job. I remember reading some interview with John Updike, and it says, you know, he like the dentist, he goes to his office, he turns on his light, he works until the end of closing, and then goes. And you haven't written more than John Updike.
No, I have not. But I was thinking...
You're much younger.
I was thinking about that Ethan Kanan story when he and I did the panel together in San Francisco. And it was... I'd never met him before. And you had never met him before. I had no story about him. And we were at the San Francisco Book Fair. And it was just the two of us, and my publicist had gotten the time of the start wrong. This is all these stories about me being late. But when I got there, it had already started. He had gone on ahead of me, which he should have, but I was frantic and apologetic and ran up and took my chair. And he was very famous at that point, and I absolutely was not. And most of the questions that were directed were going to him, and they were, you know, what do you have to do to be a real writer? And he said, well, you cannot be a real writer unless you have an office outside your home, and you get up in the morning and you put on a coat and tie and you go to the office and you keep regular office hours. And I said, well, I really respect that, and I'm so glad that works for you, and that's so interesting. But actually, no, I don't do that at all. I work in my pajamas. I work at home. Half the time I don't work at all. I
do
a lot more than you. And then his next thing was nobody could call themselves a real writer unless they had a visual dictionary. I said, I've never heard of a visual dictionary. Have you guys heard of a visual dictionary? It's
They're
really cool.
They're
I immediately went out and got one so I could be a real writer like Ethan. But it's a big book. It looks like a dictionary, and there's like a picture of a carburetor, and then there are little lines, and it shows you the name of every single part of the carburetor, or the human heart, or
and
a cat.
And it also means that if you're wondering what that thing in the human heart or carburetor is, you can look up by picture.
Right.
And then see the...
It's a way to show off, you know, to have your character sound smart about something that you don't know anything about. But we had this hysterical exchange where he kept saying, well, you have to be X. And I was saying, oh, I've never been X. His last proclamation was, it is impossible to be a real writer unless you've had a child. Because you cannot know, a human being cannot know what it means to love until a human being has had a child.
Yeah, that Flannery O'Connor. Just think of what she might have accomplished.
Yeah, Eudora
Welty. Carson McCullers.
I don't think Chekhov had kids.
Yeah.
You
know. Oh,
and that was the moment. And he just had a baby. You know, it wasn't like he had a passel of teenagers in him. But that was the moment that I turned my whole body and like, big guy, you and me, out on the street right now.